Good morning, everyone. Thank you for waking up and missing out on the parade outside, I guess. We appreciate it. So my name is Chris Segoyan. I work for the American Civil Liberties Union. I'm a technologist. I work on the team that does all of our government surveillance work. And my colleague here, my friend and colleague, Sarah, can introduce yourself?
Hi. Thanks again for coming on a morning, 10 a.m. Some of you may be hungover. I realize that it's a pain to be here, but we appreciate it. I'm an attorney, and I focused on free speech and privacy issues, as well as intellectual property. And I work at an online privacy startup in Boston called Abine. And in my personal life, I am a cosplayer and video gamer, so I feel very at home among this crowd this week.
All right, so today we're going to be discussing Google Glass, its implications for privacy, and the many ways that Google Glass and similar technologies are likely to be changing our lives once they come to us in the next few years.
And we have some slides, but they're very basic, and so we encourage you to speak up if you have any questions. Like, don't feel like you need to wait till the end. If anything comes up, just ask us. We're more than happy to oblige. So, how many of you actually know what Google Glass is? Can you raise your hand? Okay, so all of you pretty much know. now, Glass is in the Explorer version right now, so people who... How much does it cost? Like $1,500?
Yeah, so it's available to developers right now for $1,500 a go, and you have to agree to Google's terms and conditions. Well, we all have to agree to Google's terms and conditions, but these folks have to agree to an additional set of terms and conditions, and that includes Google having control over which kinds of apps are being developed for the platform right now.
Like right now, you can't use advertising. You can't do facial recognition, which we'll get to. But of course, despite not being able to do these things, I mean, we're talking about developers and hackers, and they've already gotten around pretty much everything that you're not supposed to do by this point.
So if any of you know what jailbreaking or rooting is, you can modify your phone and get administrative control. People have done that same thing for their Google Glass devices already, so they've broken out of the existing sandbox and the controls that Google has placed and enabled themselves to be able to do things that they wouldn't normally otherwise be able to do with a device. I mean, after all, the Google Glass really is just an Android phone. It runs the Android operating system. It just has a little bit of additional hardware and a much better battery.
Yes. And so, essentially, you know, this is the stuff of science fiction, but it's here today, which is kind of exciting for geeks like me. And basically how it appears to the viewer is as a little inset screen in the top right of your area of vision. So it's designed not to get in the way of what you're doing, but we'll talk in a bit about whether that's actually true from an etiquette standpoint and things like that. So that's actually a hangout right there. So you can hang out with somebody, basically video chat in real time. And I should say before we get started that a lot of this is really cool. Like, I think this is really, really cool. And we're talking about the privacy implications because they're real and they could potentially be severe. But I don't want to say that, you know, this thing shouldn't exist or that we should curtail innovation because of privacy issues. I'm just saying that we need to be cognizant about them and try to treat them in a intelligent manner. Here's just another screenshot of how it appears to the viewer, and they're taking a video right there.
So I think the first thing to mention here is that if you're standing in front of someone who has one of these Google Glass devices on their head and it's taking video, there doesn't necessarily need to be any visual indication to others in the room that the thing's shooting. Normally, you will see a picture in your glass display when you are taking video footage. And so if someone's standing relatively close to you, they can sort of see, not the reflection, but they can see the display being shown in your glass. So they can have an idea that you're doing something, but there's no immediate clear visual indicator that this device is recording.
Well, there is and there isn't. Generally, there's not. But you're supposed to give a cue that you are. There are several cues. One is to say, okay, Glass, record a video. So yeah, whatever you're doing...
That's the user doing it.
Right. But, well, there's a light, though, that displays when there's video going on, but that's already been hacked around. So, I mean, in a perfect world, if you're following all the rules, there would be a very big visible light while you're recording a video, but, like I said, that's already been circumvented.
So, clearly, the light that exists, whatever indication exists, is not immediately hardwired to the camera. Is that correct?
Yes.
If it can be disabled, then it's not hardwired. You know, we've seen sort of a trend in the last few years, which is that many of you have laptops, and laptops usually typically include an indicator light that's next to the webcam. And as we've moved from laptops to tablets and smartphones, although the tablets and smartphones generally have cameras, few, if any of them, have indicator lights showing when the cameras are being used. And so this is a crucial privacy-enhancing technology. It's something that those of us who worry about government surveillance, and we'll get more into this in a little bit, or stalkers, that light is a really good indicator to you that something bad is happening. And increasingly, we're seeing consumer electronics devices like phones and tablets not include either any form of indicator light or a light that is not hardwired to the electronics of the camera mechanism.
That actually just reminded me of RATS, remote access technology. Like, if you ever see your webcam light pop on and you're not using Skype, you're not using anything that uses that, you should be pretty wary, because it is very easy for somebody to just connect remotely to your webcam. And there's a great Ars Technica story on this if you want to be scared shitless about using your computer, especially sitting naked in front of your computer in your house. But the lo-fi solution is to just take a piece of electrical tape and put it over the camera. I actually have it on all my computers except this one, but it works. Another piece of Glass and how you initiate recording or photos is not just the verbal cue of, okay, Glass, take a picture or take a video, but you can tilt your head at a certain angle, which is 30 degrees by default. But you can change that depending on how uncomfortable or awkward that feels. So if you're in a crowd of people and you see, you know, a Glass wearer going like this, you can generally suspect that he is starting a video or a photo. And also, by default, Glass videos are 10 seconds, but you can go into the settings and extend that. Or you can extend that verbally and just say, keep going.
Quick question. Have any of the developing kids been shipped to Japan? Japanese people have been pretty aggressive about privacy protection for cameras. They have to make a noise when they're taking a picture.
Yeah, I don't know if they've been sent there. I imagine there are developers who develop for the Japanese market who have them no matter what, whether they're American developers or whether they're Japanese developers who've sent them back to their colleagues or sold them on eBay. Yes, sir. It's my understanding that there are some laptops where the light is completely software controlled. The program or the driver for the camera turns on the light, and there are others where there is a more automatic mechanism.
But when you're saying hardwire, that's one wire to there. That's not software.
Right.
HP is the worst like that.
All right, so let's keep going.
Yeah. So essentially what Google Glass offers people is a real-life heads-up display. And, you know, the recording of really high definition videos and photos easily. And I just think the heads up display is really cool because I'm a video gamer and I would love to see that type of augmented reality. This is Arkham City, if you guys have seen it. But essentially, augmented reality is the overlay of additional information or details on things that already exist. So like in Batman, he can use his x-ray vision to see, you know, who has a gun and what their heart rate is and all these additional details. And Google Glass really is the beginning of that type of augmented reality in our world, which is exciting, but also scary in certain ways. And this is probably the scariest way.
Yeah.
Chris is an expert in this, so I'm going to hand it over.
So, Glass has the potential to be, Glass and similar technology have the potential to be really, really useful to our lives. And they have the potential to allow us to keep our government in check. If you are walking down the street and you see the police doing something that they maybe shouldn't be doing, having a device on you that where you can easily record without even drawing attention to yourself might be useful for preserving evidence that there was some kind of wrongdoing happening. But Glass is a double-edged sword. Glass and similar technology are a double-edged sword in that we might find ourselves moving in a direction where they can be used against us. As I said, Google's Glass product is at its core just a cell phone. And it's a computing device, and computing devices run software written by humans, and humans make mistakes. And any software probably has a few security flaws in it, and it's for that reason that, you know, once a month, if not more frequently on your computer, you'll get a notice telling you that you need to install a security update. Right, whether you're using a Mac or Windows, you will get regular security updates. And if you don't install those updates, bad things can happen. And I don't mean, you know, the world collapsing, but people can abuse those security holes and hack into your computer, hack into your device, steal your data. And we have a problem in this country. In fact, it's a global problem, but it's one that I've been focusing on here, which is that consumers don't receive regular security updates for their smartphones. The Android is the majority operating system in this country, and in most countries now, the majority smartphone operating system. But consumers are lucky if they get a single software update through the life of an Android phone. Most of the Android devices that are out there today are still running a variant on Gingerbread, which is about a year and a half, 2 years old. Consumers just don't get the updates. Now, this isn't because Google isn't capable of delivering updates, but when you get into the cell phone business and you have to work with the wireless carriers and you have to work with hardware companies, they may not want to distribute updates as frequently as Google does. I'm not blaming Google here, but the end result is that most people are running old, insecure software on their smartphones and on their tablets, which could be taken advantage of by a hacker, whether that hacker is an individual, a criminal, a stalker, or the government. Now, about 3 weeks ago, I gave a talk at a hacker conference called DEF CON, which is in Las Vegas. I guess a very, very different conference to this one, except that people at both conferences wear utility kilts. I presented the results of about 6 months of research showing that the FBI now has a team of people who do nothing but hack into the computers and cell phones of individuals. We learned just last night, the Washington Post had a front page story talking about the NSA's cyber operations team, the Tailored Operations, TAO, Tailored Operations, Tailored Access Operations, that's what they're called. And they've spent $25 million in the last year just acquiring information about vulnerabilities in consumer software so that they can leverage those vulnerabilities and hack into people's devices. So I'm really concerned that the first thing is that Glass is not going to receive regular updates. I think that a device with a camera and microphone that you're wearing at all times should be receiving updates as frequently as your laptop, if not more frequently. I'm worried that the webcam that you wear in your face will see stuff that is vastly more sensitive than things than the webcam in your phone or even the webcam in your computer. I was at another technical conference a couple of weeks ago where there was someone from Google attending, and like many Google employees, he had a Google Glass device and he walked into the bathroom and kept it on the whole time. Now, I'm sure he wasn't recording, But you need to trust the security of your device to leave it on at all times, in all places. And so I'm very concerned that the Glass device might be used against people without their knowledge. The other thing I think folks really need to be thinking about is if we have these devices where we are... Do you want me to wait until you're done with your call? If we have these devices that are capable of recording, capable of both recording video and audio, at some point the government may come and ask for that audio and video. We are essentially embracing a crowdsourced surveillance model, although it's one in which we are paying for the devices that are surveilling each other. I think we really need to think through the legal issues and the cultural issues of what it means to have widely distributed surveillance cameras. Right, it's one thing when the surveillance camera is pointed or is installed in the corner of the room. It's another when it's walking around with us. What happens when the police ask for that footage later? And so these camera devices do present serious privacy and security considerations. You know, it's my hope that at some point there will be significant effort dedicated to making sure that these devices cannot be used against their users. Yes, sir?
It seems like Google's own devices, like the Nexus series, do get pretty regular updates in terms of other devices. So is that, do you think that's still a concern for Google's device, or are you more concerned about similar devices that other manufacturers
have? Yeah, so I have a Nexus 4 here. This is my third Android phone, and it took me a little while to realize that I needed not only a Nexus phone, but I needed the right kind of Nexus phone, because it turns out the Nexus phones sold by Verizon and Sprint don't get regular updates either. You know, I think it's easy when you are developing a prototype device or a device aimed at developers, but the way you achieve mass market dominance is by partnering with other companies, and I think that, you know, we'll wait and see how Google proceeds on this Glass platform. If they decide to make the device themselves and control everything, that'll be one thing. But if they have to partner with Samsung or HTC, or they have to partner with the wireless carriers, because this device is going to want, you know, an internet connection too, those companies, their partners, may be less inclined to provide a secure experience and provide regular free updates. Sir,
just quick ignorance. Videos kept on glasses or up to the cloud? Because if it's up,
they
in the
automatically
cloud,
sync to the cloud whenever you're in a network connection.
Is immediate. They don't have to come to ask you for it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. So if you were storing this stuff locally on the device, in theory, you might be the only one with access to that. But because a big part of Glass is this auto sync to Google servers, like that, I mean, that is a feature that they're selling, right? You know, you get this video and immediately it's in the cloud and you can share it with all of your contacts. Super convenient, yes, but then Google has it, and as we know from all of this NSA stuff, once it's on their servers, you know, your control over that is diminished or non-existent. Do you guys know what the third-party doctrine is? Because like it sounds complicated, but I can explain it really easily. Essentially, it's a legal principle that says that, let's say I have a secret, right, and I want to keep it from Chris, but I tell you, right? So under the third-party doctrine, because I told you and you're a third party, I have no expectation anymore in that secret. So Chris can't say, oh, that's a secret.
Well, like, it's more if I'm the government. So if you involve a third party in your affairs, whether it's your bank or your telephone company or your email provider, the Supreme Court ruled in two problematic cases in the 70s, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy for that information, which means that the government can obtain your banking records or other information without a warrant signed by a judge. They can use what's called a subpoena, which is a letter. The FBI agents will have a pad of blank subpoenas in the way that a doctor will have a pad of blank prescriptions. There's no neutral judge who's evaluating the facts and deciding that yes, there's probable cause. I mean, so I think, you know, what Sarah is describing here is on the law enforcement front is the double-edged nature of Glass. So the good side is if you're at a protest and you see the police beating someone and you have your Glass device on and you're filming them, because the video is automatically being uploaded to the cloud, if the police see what you're doing and come up to you and tear the glass off your face and smash it, the video is safe. You have preserved evidence of police wrongdoing. The flip side, though, is if you know something happens, the police can first contact Google or the phone companies and say, tell us everyone who was within a mile of this incident when it happened. And then they can contact Google or other communications companies and say, give us any video footage that was automatically uploaded. Oh, and by the way, don't tell the people who created the video footage. We don't want you to tell them.
It's like a difference of surveillance versus suvalence. How many of you guys have heard that term, suvalence? So it basically means surveillance done by the little guy, basically. Like, surveillance is Big Brother watching you. Suvalence is you watching your world. And so the potential of things like glass is to create a world in which there's not just Big Brother, but there are lots of little brothers, and that would be all of you wearing glass. So in theory, it could be empowering because you're all catching everything that you're doing on tape. If there's a police abuse, many people would have recorded that. Right now, surveillance is very one-sided. It is the big guys against us. But there is an argument to be made that if we're all watching too, then it sort of levels the playing field a little bit. The fact that all this data is stored in the cloud, though, means that it is very accessible, and that's not really... The fact is that the laws protecting digital information are much, much weaker than they should be. You guys all know that if you send a letter, for example, in snail mail, it's illegal for somebody to just go and open it up and look through it. However, if you send an email, people rifle through that stuff all the time. I mean, there's virtually no protection in email. And so that's sort of the structure on which Google Glass is based. Like, we're going to collect all the data possible, and you can't really say or know how it's going to be used later, potentially against you.
I think we have a question, yes.
I just had a point that I wanted to clarify and a question. It's my understanding that Glass requires a mobile phone to sync to in order to get mobile data. Which is both very nice and bad. Nice because, you know, you can leave your phone somewhere and then walk away, and then it's like, okay, I know that it can't get anywhere because I'm not connected to my phone. But at the same time, if you're in a hotel room, and Bluetooth is horrible as far as being hijacked, and the person over says, oh, let me see if anybody has Google Glass in a Bluetooth range, and then now they can see into your room. You know, and I think that that's... just another point of failure for something like Google Glass that people may not be aware of if they're just thinking of it as a standalone device that doesn't connect to other things except to just the cloud.
Yeah, I mean, I think you should understand that the hardware scenario you described there is true today, but will almost certainly not be the case in 2 or 3 years. At some point in the very near future, I would be shocked if there was not a cell phone modem embedded within the Google Glass, and it didn't need to tether with your phone. I mean, hell, in a few years, you won't have a cell phone anymore. It'll just be your wristwatch or something, or maybe it'll just be the Google Glass. Maybe that's all you'll need, and then a few more years after that, it'll just be embedded in your skull. I think the fact that right now it's tethering off of your cell phone connection is for two reasons. One, it means that the battery in the device doesn't have to be as large. It also, you know, everyone who is buying a Glass probably already has an Android phone. Google knows their audience. They can offload some of the processing to another device. It means they can have a less fast processor in the Glass. It also means that they don't have to ask people to spend another $30 or $50 a month for a Glass data connection that they would if the device had a modem. But I do think that is a momentary issue, and I think things are going to change very quickly there.
You mentioned that government agencies can essentially issue subpoenas at will to Google and get all this information. What kind of ability does Google have to say no?
That's a really good question. So I finished my PhD last year, which was specifically focused on the role that internet companies play in facilitating surveillance of their customers. So I know a little bit about this stuff. We have different standards in the United States depending on what kind of information the government wants to get. So if they want to get information about where you logged in from, or what your name is, or what your address is, or the credit card number you used, or the IP address where you logged in from, they need a subpoena. There exists some disagreement between the government and civil liberties groups as to whether the government can obtain records of where you go on the internet, the URLs that you have gone, with or without a warrant. The government's view is they don't need a warrant. Our view is that they do need a warrant, and we're very much looking forward to the opportunity to litigate that at some point. At least one circuit court, at least one appeals court, has ruled that the government needs a warrant signed by a judge to obtain your emails. Although when Congress created our current existing privacy law in 1986, and it hasn't really been updated since, they created some pretty crazy things. I mean, so you have to understand that in 1986, the internet was a very different place. If you had an email account, you had a 2 megabyte inbox. If you had a cell phone, it was as big as this, and the battery lasted an hour, although maybe the battery stuff hasn't changed that much. and so Congress, you know, back in 1986, if you received an email, you would read it and delete it. And the reason you deleted it was because you needed the space in your inbox for the next email that would come in later. You didn't keep emails for 5 years in 1986. And so what Congress did when it created the law, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, it said that emails that were older than 180 days were essentially abandoned and could be obtained without a warrant by the police. Also, emails, once they've been opened once, shifted from being protected by a warrant to being protected with a subpoena. So the idea was, well, once you've read it, why would you hang, if you've held onto it, it doesn't really matter anymore. That was before the world we live in now, where you check your email on your phone, skim it, and then you will look at it later in greater depth. So luckily, at least one appellate court has said that that's stupid, and has said that emails are protected across the board with a warrant. But the Supreme Court has not yet weighed in, and Congress hasn't really fixed the situation. You know, in 1986, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there were no search engines that were really any good. And it was a very, very different world. Google is actually better than most. In fact, so the phone companies are awful when it comes to privacy. And Google is actually sort of at the front of the pack, even in the internet company, in the market for internet companies. So they will insist on a warrant for emails. They will insist on a warrant for your records of what you search for. They publish transparency reports revealing how many requests they get from law enforcement agencies. And they're currently litigating with the National Security Agency over whether they can provide statistics about how many requests they get in the intelligence context. So they're pretty good there. But you know, ultimately what you have to understand is those laws merely govern when the police can get your email. But even in the best case scenario, where the company says, we demand a warrant, they're going to get a warrant at some point, and then they're going to get your email. And so really the only way for companies to protect your information is to not store it in the first place. And it's very, very difficult to offer an advertising-supported service that you get for free that throws your data away when you don't need it anymore. Google's business model is, we collect all your data, we mine your data for things that suggest what you're interested in, and then we deliver advertisements to you targeted off of your data. And no one has yet figured out how to do that without storing all the data, and when you store it, the government can come and ask for it later. There's certainly the potential for companies to offer services that are better than that, services that either deleted your data the moment you're done with it, or that encrypt it with a password or key that the company doesn't know about themselves. But for that, you'd have to pay for it. And none of us pay for Google Mail unless we're using the corporate version of Google Mail. None of us pay for Facebook or Twitter. And so if we want companies to offer services that really protect our data from the government at all times, we need to start paying. And you know, we pay for our phone bills, we pay for our cable connections at home, many of us pay for content online, not everyone, but many of us pay for content online. And so I don't think it's unreasonable to say that we should pay $20 a year for email. But as long as we are getting our email for free and our cloud storage for Google Glass for free, there's only so much the companies can do when the government comes and asks for our data.
Yeah.
So on your phone, you can disable automatic sync of Gmail and Calendar. Will that also disable video uploads?
I would imagine it would. I haven't played with the device. I mean, someone let me put it on my head for about 5 seconds, but I haven't had an extensive session with it yet. I would imagine that they will allow the disabling of automatic syncing. I'm not. Do you know what the storage on the glass is?
Not off the top of my head.
I would be shocked if there's enough storage for you to store days and days worth of stuff on there. So they're going to either need to offload it to your phone or put it somewhere. But I would imagine that they will allow the disabling of automatic syncing. You know, as is always the case, though, the defaults matter. So merely offering an option to turn off automatic syncing isn't going to apply for most users because most people never change their default settings. The defaults matter more than anything else.
Uh-huh. Hey, and I wandered in late, so I apologize if this has been asked already. So if I am just a regular internet user, I can opt out of Google fairly easily by not using it and maybe blocking it from my computer and such. However, what if I'm walking down the street and I run into somebody who is wearing Google Glass? Is there any way that I can opt out of that?
Well, there are 2 points. First, it's actually harder than you described to opt out of Google because anytime that you go anywhere on the web and you see a Google Plus button, any sort of Google widget, I mean, Google Analytics,
Omniture.
Yeah, YouTube. I mean, Google is the internet. So it's virtually impossible to do anything without leaving some footprint of what you're doing with that company. Tracking alone, the passive tracking that happens on every website that you visit, I mean, Google is 75% of that, them or their companies. So it's really, I would say it's impossible to opt out if you're an internet user. But yeah, I mean, if you're on the street, that's a whole new frontier. And that's a world that we're entering very, very quickly. And it raises a lot of interesting etiquette questions. For example, like if you see somebody with glass, you should probably assume that they're recording, or at least that they have the very easy capacity to start doing that. And it's kind of awkward, right? Like, do you ask them not to record you? Do you ask them to take it off if you're at a social event? Like, how many of you have ever been to an event with your friends and you all sort of collectively agree to not use your cell phones? Like, 3 of you? 4. That actually is kind of fun. You should try it. But it's going to have to be awkward. It's a little bit weird for you. The burden might be on you as the person potentially being observed to say, hey, I'm not cool with this. And it does shrink the size of the private space. You know, if you're out in the world right now on the street at a conference, you assume that that's public. You assume that people could take pictures of you. But when people have wearable tech like glass that goes with them everywhere, into bathrooms, into bedrooms, into private parties, they're essentially shrinking private space and potentially recording anywhere that they go. So it does change things a lot.
Yes. Hang on, let me just add on 2 more things. One moment, sir. So, to your point, so right now we know what Google Glass looks like because there's only one company that's selling it, and it looks fairly unique. I think that in time that will change also. I think we are going to get very quickly to a point where there are going to be many glass type devices and they may look very similar to regular glasses. Particularly if you're using sunglasses as opposed to clear glasses, you may not even be able to see the display. And so you may not realize that the person who's standing across the bar from you has a device like that on. Remember, the only thing that's giving it away is the display, not the camera. And so we may find that people have devices that are sort of like half a Google Glass, right? They have the camera and the microphone, but not the display. You know, the part that sort of worries me the most about everyone wandering around with these things, one of the things that worries me the most, is the intrusion upon traditionally protected or private spaces. And there are places where we show people a side of ourselves that we wouldn't show everyone else. One easy example is the changing room in a gym. So what happens when someone walks into the changing room of your gym with a glass on and you're either walking around in a towel or less than a towel? You don't know if that person has it on. Do you rely on them pinky swearing and saying that they haven't turned it on, or does the gym adopt a policy of not allowing those devices in there. You know, one thing that I think many people haven't realized yet is that these devices are very quickly going to become assisted technology devices for the disabled, right? So if you are vision impaired or you have some other disability, these devices are great. Like really, really good. You know, what if you are vision impaired and you are streaming live video to your spouse who is telling you what she or he are seeing on the display so that you can figure out what's going on in front of you? Well, what happens if you walk into the changing room and you're live streaming to someone who's providing you with essential service? Well, you know, we haven't thought through those issues. What if there's a child changing in that gym changing room and the child is naked? Well, in some states, you're really not supposed to be taking video or camera footage of a naked child, particularly if it's not your child. There are some real issues that people haven't thought through yet. Can you exclude someone with a Google Glass device from entering your store or your business? Well, what if it's an assisted device? What if it is providing a service to allow them to just get through in life? Well, that creates some really interesting questions.
Almost as kind of like a dovetail to that question, has anybody actually tried to develop technology that blocks the ability to shoot video or photos? Basically, if you're near somebody who has this hypothetical device, it can is it possible that it could detect that there's a Google Glass somewhere in its area and basically force that Google Glass to not record?
So I know that there are some technologies that I think use lasers to mess with the autofocus in cameras, but given the proximity of the glass camera to your eyeball, that seems like a really, really bad idea. It's tough to jam cameras. There may be technology that exists.
There's masks.
The other question is, like, how do you opt out of glass? Well, you do what the gentleman in the front row is doing here. I think gentleman, maybe woman. opt out through your clothing.
There's some interesting developments that have happened. I have the facial recognition slide up too, because that's a big privacy issue with glass. But to thwart not only glass but facial recognition, like interesting types of makeup application where you're throwing off the facial detection algorithms because you know this might look like an eye here, or hats with lights that will flash as soon as there's a camera flash. There's all kinds of like wearable tech. Actually, a drone. Did you see that like drone hoodie that you can put on that it essentially reduces your heat signature so that if a drone was looking for human life below, you wouldn't show up.
So let's back up for a second and talk about like what is facial recognition and why is it scary? And then we'll talk about the facial recognition and glass.
So first, there's a distinction between facial recognition, which would be the dudes with the mustaches on the left, and facial detection, which is the cookie on the right. That's actually Apple's iPhoto, and it likes to look for what it thinks are faces, and that it has determined is an unknown chocolate chip cookie face. But facial recognition is the ability to detect not only that a face exists, but whose face it is. So, you know, everybody has fingerprints, everybody has unique identifiers like that. Your face is also one of them. And it might be the most identifying UDID that you have because you only have one, it goes with you everywhere. It's very difficult to change without plastic surgery or extreme pain. But the statistics about where your eyes are in relation to your nose and your mouth and how deep your cheeks are and things gives you a unique face print. And technology exists today that can, like for example, a cell phone app where I could take a picture of one of you and that would basically scan your face and cross-reference it with a database of publicly available information from sites like LinkedIn and Facebook, Google Image Search, and basically figure out who you are. And once we know who you are and your name, it's very easy to find out where you live, your estimated net worth, religious, political views, because public record sites on the internet are so pervasive. And there was actually a famous Carnegie Mellon study by Alessandro Acquisti who postulated that you could take somebody's picture, get all this data, and then find out their social security number in a significant number of cases. So let's
back up for a second and talk about a couple other aspects to this issue. Many of us lead separate lives, either in person or online. You may have a LinkedIn profile and you may have an online dating profile. And the information in those profiles may be completely separate. You don't list your job in your dating profile, and you don't list that you like long walks on the beach in your professional social networking profile. But the common element between those two profiles is likely going to be your face. And we've had it fairly easy up until now in that we are able to live these completely separate lives because it's not easy to link those things. Now, every once in a while, you may, you know, encounter a situation where one of your colleagues or your friends from real life is browsing through an online dating site and they see your profile, and then, you know, there's like that awkward conversation when they say they saw you, or you see them in the list of people who've browsed your profile. But for the most part, you're able to lead these separate lives, and that's because there's no easy way to match the two. That is disappearing. There are already websites that will let you not do facial recognition, but let you compare photos. And it turns out you don't really even need facial recognition to match or people's profiles from various sites, because the hard truth is that most of us only have a couple photos of us that make us look good. You may have hundreds of photos of you, but there's just a couple that make you look that little bit thinner or that little bit more attractive. And so you tend to use that photo everywhere. You will have the same photo on your online dating site. Whether you will have the same photo on a Craigslist adult misconnections ad. You will have the same photo on your professional headshot on the company website. You will have the same photo everywhere. And there are websites like Google Image Search or TinEye or a few others where you can paste in the URL for a photo and it'll tell you everywhere else on the web where that photo is also has also been observed. And people are already using this to re-identify online dating photos and other things. One second, sir. I think it's also critical to bear in mind that there are some people who lead lives online that they don't want the rest of the world to know about. For many reasons, the example that I think works best here is that there are dating websites for people with incurable sexually transmitted diseases. There are dating websites for people with HIV who want to find other people with HIV, and there's sort of an honor code. Like, you only go to that website if you have this disease and you wish to find someone else who has it too. There's no one else who's going to be browsing that website, and you have to sign up with a username and password, so Google's never going to index that stuff for now. The potential for facial or image recognition allows the piercing of that shield and allows the re-identification of photos in those kinds of databases with Facebook profiles and LinkedIn profiles and office profiles and photos taken at Comic-Con and DragonCon and other events. I think that the potential for easy to use, scalable facial and photo recognition in the next few years is probably one of the biggest privacy threats we're facing. And the real concern that I have, I think that many people in my field have, is that by the time the technology is ready to go and easily available, there'll be nothing we can do to stop it, because there'll be so many of our photos that are out there. Once the technology is ready to go, it's not like you can suddenly claw back every photo you've ever uploaded. They're all out there. So I'm just setting the stage, because that technology is coming. And so Google has prohibited any developer from releasing a facial recognition app for Glass, not because they don't think that the developers can do it, but because they are worried about the media frenzy and backlash against Glass as a whole if the Glass device becomes the poster child for creepy facial recognition. Do you sort of agree with that?
And it's actually already been invented, though. I think 3 weeks ago, developers announced that they have built facial recognition apps that work with almost 100% recognition accuracy. So Yep.
Hang on. I think, were you first, or was there the gentleman? Okay, go ahead. Sorry. Yeah, wait for the mic.
There are companies right now that work in conjunction with advertisers that amalgamate images, so that it'll take pictures from people at a health clinic or something and mix them with like a little Tom Cruise or Robert Redford or whatever, so you don't actually have a face that somebody can sue for the usage of. And this software is really good. I've seen this stuff in operation. You just have to get one of those machines to constantly be adding randomized images by the billions to the internet, swamp out these facial recognition things, because you only need within what, you know, 0.5% of 1%. And
so what you're saying is the solution to protecting myself is to just mix in a bit of Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt in my online dating profile?
Well, if a dating
well,
website,
yes.
You can see it'd be hard to argue with that. But
yeah.
any sort of image domain, image-rich domain that would want to defend itself would simply have a data buffer region where the data is swamped by a proliferation of images
right.
that are amalgamated. For every one picture of you, 1,000, hybrids.
Right, so the question is, what happens when you show up on that blind date and you don't look 1/10 like Brad Pitt?
Yeah.
Yeah, another question
okay.
that comes to mind. So if I am working with, say, medical data, and like a doctor takes an x-ray and puts it in, there's laws like HIPAA that protect that. Are there any such laws protecting something like a facial image that I upload to LinkedIn or something?
I mean, other than copyright, not that I know of, really. I mean, once you upload it, you have almost no interest or control in privacy in that image, so. Actually, what you just said jogged my memory that a surgeon did the first ever glass broadcast of surgery this week, which is kind of an interesting
news.
Awesome. Yeah.
So on the legality, I'll say, the facial recognition stuff aside, in many states, there are existing wiretap laws relating to when you can record audio without the consent of other people. So I live in Washington, D.C., which is what's called a one-party consent city. So as long as one person in the room knows that there's a recording being made, they don't have to tell anyone else. Many states are two-party consent or or all-party consent, which means at least two or all of the people present need to be told that there's a recording. There are some really interesting issues. Like if you are recording audio with your glass device and you haven't told everyone else in the room and your state requires all-party consent, there may be some serious legal issues there. These wiretapping laws have actually been used to go after individuals who recorded the police. It's one thing, I think, if you're holding up a camera and you're pointing at the police, there's some kind of sort of built-in notice that you're recording either video or photographic information. But again, with glass, it might not be clear to everyone else in the room what you're doing. There's not exactly a big flashing sign saying, warning, I'm recording. So that is something that I think folks, the individuals, are going to have to reckon with, not the developers of the platform.
That actually happened recently, where somebody caught a fight with glass on like a New Jersey boardwalk, which is, you know, classy and known for fights like that. So the guy was just walking around. He happened to be recording. He didn't even have to touch glass or do any sort of cues. And he just walked and turned, and there was like this huge brawl going on. He caught it all on film and then went to the police, and they were able to identify and arrest the right guy. So.
With facial recognition?
You know, looking at the video and finding the right Guido guy. And just before we leave facial recognition entirely, it's not just your online images that can be synced and compared like Chris was describing, but it's also in real life. Like if you went to a private party and you didn't intend on using your real name, you didn't want people to know that you were there, or maybe let's say a protest or some sort of like political meeting. Even if you don't give out your name or other identifying information, the potential exists for somebody to find that out anyway through your face alone.
I mean, we saw a non-high-tech version of this not a couple years ago. There was an event in in Boulder, Colorado, every year, a mass protest against what used to be the state's prohibition on use of marijuana, and the police took photographs of lots of people who were smoking pot and posted them online, then offered prizes or awards to identify these pot smokers. So that was crowdsourcing. That wasn't using facial recognition, but it's an example of the fact that, you know, your face can reveal who you are, even if your name isn't hanging from a sign on your neck.
That actually happened with the protests in Canada, too, where they took extremely high-def images and were able
crowd.
To, yeah, like extremely high-def, where you could, I mean, there I saw them on Reddit, where you could go in to the level of a person's zits. Like, it was crazy. Crowds of multi-thousands. Yes.
Quick question. When you use the voice data loading for Google, does it actually maintain an image of your voice? Can my voice be correlated across? I mean, I assume NSA has a full profile of all our voices anyway from cell phone use.
So,
but what about Google? Do they explicitly maintain a voice profile?
You mean, I think there's two questions there. One is the device maintaining a voice profile, and then second is that device profile being maintained across multiple devices? So you would want there to be a profile for your voice on the device.
Yes, it is.
You would want there...
It's coming.
So you want, I mean, and what happens is that over time the device figures out, you know, what your voice is like, and it will get better, which is a good thing. I think we generally want our devices to not get confused as often as they do right now. So the question is, when the glass that you own will eventually falls into the toilet and breaks, and you go to the Google store and you buy a new one, do you want to have to go through another 3-month training period, or do you want it to automatically use the learning data that it had previously obtained? And I think the answer is that we probably do want it to do that. I don't think we want to go through a 3-month training cycle every time we get a new device.
The reason I bring it up is one camera is required on face, one camera on face to identify an individual, but for an audio source, one guy could have an open mic in here, which constitutes any cell phone that doesn't have the battery taken out of it. And he has not only a recording of what was said, but actually our identities. Because, you know, mm-hmm. how many data points do you need before you can uniquely identify a voice? A lot less every year, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm more afraid of fingerprints.
Right. So vocal fingerprints are actually really crappy for authentication. So, I mean, before I was working with lots of lawyers, I was a computer security researcher, and in terms of biometric authentication, fingerprints are good because you have the same fingerprint every day for the most part, unless you suddenly start doing lots of heavy labor and play with acid. Your fingerprints will stay the same, but and your face will stay the same, and your retinas will stay the same, but your voice, if you are hungover or sick, your voice changes. If you get woken up early in the morning, your voice changes, and that wreaks havoc on a biometric identification system. It's not actually a good identifier. There may be ways to predict what your voice sounds like when you're sick, but it's not nearly as good as other forms of authentication.
When you're using voice recognition, you need to have the mic generally in the same location, which would indicate that voice recognition, to determine who someone is, you're going to have a mic right there, not over here. It's going to have a different effect over distance, so voice is not really an issue about that.
My understanding is the device does learn some kind of print for its owner.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's stored locally or transmitted back. Like, I know if you're using Siri, for example, on iOS devices, that's all sent to Apple's servers and processed there. Although the phone has the capability to do that locally, it's all sent to Apple servers. To the extent that certain businesses, like I think IBM it was, forbade any of their employees from using Siri during business meetings because they didn't want any recordings of goings-on being sent to Apple servers. I know at least with the Moto X, which is with, like, one of the newest Android phones, that voice processing happens locally, which presents almost no privacy issues.
I mean, so to respond completely to your question, you could have a voice print that was stored online that was encrypted with a password that only you knew. So it was available online, you could synchronize it across all new devices, but Google could never get it, and more importantly, the NSA could never get it. But that would require an engineering effort on the part of the company. And they haven't done that. So I think we're running out of time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. If you guys have more questions, we're happy to. Yeah, I mean, I think this is an icon from a group called Stop the Cyborgs that distribute these freely and encourage businesses to put them up. There actually are a couple of bars and places already that are Google Glass-free zones. We are at our office. I put one up on our door. But, I mean, when you think about it, it will fundamentally change the way that people act. I mean, if you know that you're being watched or recorded, you know that you act differently. Like, you're not going to, you might sing in the shower or in the car, or, you know, you say different things to your boyfriend than to your grandma or to Congress. And that, there's a lot of psychological impact there. Yep.
Okay, two more questions. Here's one right here.
Hey.
Concerning the etiquette, there are, like, for example, the people that are allowed to bring dogs into restaurants if they're service animals. Is there any likelihood concerning this kind of thing, people that need a disability, like if they're going to have, if they're visually impaired, it could be a audio thing where it visually describes to you some key things, mm-hmm. like it could be key to say, you're approaching an intersection, let you know that. Or stuff like that, or it could be automatically subtitling everything that, you know, is happening around you for somebody who's deaf. Is there any likelihood of them making perhaps a dumbed down version specifically for that that wouldn't be allowed, you know, disallowed in places or have the security concerns that everybody has with these?
You know, I think, you know, one of the important distinctions between a regular dog and a service dog is usually there's some kind of visual indication that the service dog is a service dog, right? They'll have a vest or something to let people know, to let the restaurant owners or the airlines or other people know, okay, this dog is allowed in this place. You know, I think we are going to see service boss. The question is, like, how does everyone else know that it is one and it isn't just a regular glass device? And I think the answer is going to be some kind of visual indication. Maybe it'll be a different color,
yeah.
or, you know, there'll be some signal to everyone else, like, hey, this person isn't rude. This is a device letting them live their life.
Will they, like, take out perhaps some features that make people upset or concerned?
We'll have to see. I mean, we're so far from that happening, but it's probably, like, I think it'll be, you know, someone who's visually impaired has the colored tip on their cane. I think that's where it'll start most likely, so that other people can detect that. But we'll have to see.
The last question.
Do you think that Faraday cages will be incorporated to keep it from going to the cloud?
You know, Google is a cloud computing company, so I think it's unlikely they're gonna build that into their product. Will other people do that? Yeah, sure. You know, there are phone carrying cases you can buy now that are Faraday cages. But you know, they're gonna entice you to have this thing connected 24/7. You know, they want you. I mean, Google isn't gonna make money off of selling you Boss. The business model is, you're walking down the street, and suddenly you see a coupon for a pizza restaurant that's the next block over, and it'll flash up in your display. I mean, that's how they're going to make money down the road. And if you've disabled internet access to your device, they can't show you the pizza ad. So Google is going to find a way of making sure that it is connected to the internet 24/7. Thank you very much. And I'm going to be on a panel at, what, 2 o'clock this afternoon? What time? 4 o'clock this afternoon on NSA spying. So you should all come. It'll be very scary.
Thank you.